Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, wow. Good evening. This is Dr. John. And this is Scary Cast. I know everyone's excited. I know I'm excited. So as I would normally say, live. But tonight, live from Tigerville, South Carolina, Hollywood, California, and of course, Emerald Isle, North Carolina, it's Scary Cast. It's Dr. John with Dead and Fate, Papa Stro, and we've got a bang-up show for you tonight. First of all, as usual, I want to say hello to my co-hosts and see how they're doing. Devin, how are you doing tonight? How's Hollywood?
It's good. It's cold. It's a little chilly here, but it's nice to kind of go out and have some chilly weather once in a while because we don't get it all that often. So we went out and saw Mary Poppins Returns last night. Finally, that was good.
Oh, nice.
What? So it was a good movie.
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
Well, that's cool. Yeah, I mean, it's just gotten a lot of publicity, and I want to go see it. I think it'd be great. So that's good. Don't tell us anymore. We're just glad to know you liked it, and it gets two thumbs up from you, and we'll go check it out. Papa Stro, how you doing from Emerald Isle tonight?
Staying warm, actually. Been watching The Night's Tale again with my dog Sparky, so all is good.
Watching A Knight's Tale?
Yeah, with Heath Ledger.
Oh, I know. The reason I said that is I have a small announcement to make after I say, first of all, we got a couple of great things coming up. April 27th, the 2019 North Georgia Comic Con and Bigfoot Conference, that's coming up. We've got the Lizard Man Festival has returned. It's going to be June 1st, 2019. Papa Stro will be there. I sure hope you'll be there. We're going to have a blast. It's at the Button King Museum. And so that'll be a lot of fun. So we got that going on. Want to let everybody know that Scary Cast has now birthed, whether that's a correct word or not, we have now birthed a brand new affiliate podcast, and it's called Bigfoot and Company. 4 o'clock in the Eastern time on Monday afternoon, Matt Delph and I are going to talk about Bigfoot. We're doing so many darn Bigfoot conferences, we got to have a podcast to support them. So 4 p.m. on Monday, that's Bigfoot and Company. Just right, you know, you can go to Scarycast. The link is there, and it's just going to be a lot of fun. So great things happening here at Scarycast. Great things happening. I've got to make an announcement. The most important thing we got going on in January is coming up January the 23rd on Pop Culture Stars. You just go to popculturestars.com. And what's important about January 23rd, it is our third annual holiday that we celebrate, which is Papa Stro's birthday. Happy third anniversary birthday, Papa Stro, in advance.
No, thank you so much. I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, yeah, we're going to have some surprise guests. We're going to have a lot of fun, so everybody stay tuned. I'm going to put up an announcement everywhere, but Papa Stro's birthday is actually January 26th, but we always celebrate it on the podcast right before it, so it'll be a big happy birthday to Papa Stro. We'll also probably sing you a happy birthday here on Scary Cast. How's that?
Oh, that sounds great.
Okay.
I can't wait.
We're going to get Brady on Pop Culture Stars. So we're going to get Devin to lead Happy Birthday on Scary Cast. So that'll be great. But anyway, so pre-Happy Birthday to you. And we're glad we're having a great 2019. I was in Cherokee, North Carolina, working on a secret assignment. And I'll tell everybody more about that in about 2 weeks. But it's going to be exciting. And I think everybody will enjoy it if they can get there. But Cherokee is a beautiful place. I had such a wonderful time up there talking with the Eastern Band of the Cherokee Nation. They're wonderful people. And if you haven't been to Cherokee, please go up there. They've got this great heritage casino. They've got museums. They've got crafts. They've got everything. Because I'll tell you what, Cherokee, North Carolina, one of the most beautiful places in the world. Be sure to be there. get there, Highway 19, right out of Asheville. So take some time, go up there and have a great one. Now, tonight, we have a very special show. We have a very special guest. His name is Marshall. Marshall, how are you doing tonight?
Excuse me, I had to unmute. I'm doing great, John.
That's good. We are so glad to have you. I want to tell the story of how we found Marshall. He has been on Coast to Coast AM maybe a dozen times talking about Planet X or Nibiru or Nibiru or however you like to pronounce it. We're not sure. We all pronounce it a little differently. But what happened was on Christmas Day, I got an email from Coast to Coast AM that said, Merry Christmas. Here's a special archived episode of Marshall Masters talking about Planet X. Enjoy it for Christmas. So, of course, like any good Coast to Coast AM subscriber and listener, I listened to it. To be honest with you, scared the heck out of me. It was really scary. And I said, I got to meet this guy. I got to talk to him. So, sure enough, sent him a message on Facebook, and like a true champ, he answered. And Marshall, I think we've been talking it for since, haven't we?
Pardon?
I think we've been talking ever since.
Yes, we have been quite a bit, and I've enjoyed it.
That's right. And it's great. I mean, you've got one of my favorite topics, Planet X. Planet X was associated, a lot of people would associate it with 2012. But we've got some Planet X problems now. And that's what he addressed on that on his interview with George Norrie. And I believe that was from 2017. So anyway, I was so happy when Marshall agreed to come on to our show tonight and talk about it and talk about the potential problems that we've got. They're very, it's mind-boggling how this little tiny thing that people thought went away in 2012 may be lurking right around the corner. So, Marshall, first of all, greetings. You're out there in Pacific time, and so you're on the West Coast area. We're glad to have you. Tell us a little bit about yourself, first of all, and then let's start talking about Planet X. And I know we're going to have some lively discussion, so tell us a little bit about you and your background. You've got a very exciting and varied background. You've done a lot of great things.
Well, thank you. I started doing Planet X back, my first article, I believe, was January 2002. I actually started in 1999 with my website, Your Own World USA, YOWUSA.com. You can also get there with just MarshallMasters.com. And I got... the interesting thing was, it was like around 2000, I was in the computer industry. I was working in Silicon Valley, and I was a freelance consultant. My clients included AT&T, Oracle, Sun Microsystem, HP, Lockheed Martin, and I was an analyst. And I saw something in a video feed from NASA, and everybody was hot on this because it was a quatrain from Nostradamus about King of Terror. And, well, I'm the guy who found the King of Terror comet, as Nostradamus predicted. We would find it that day, and it would be difficult to find, and I did find it in the overscan region. That was in 1999, and believe it or not, I got 5 million views. That was pretty early time for the internet, and that's what launched me. At first, you know, I came around to Planet X slowly, because what I was really interested in back in the 90s, I had a travel business and specialized in former states of the Soviet Union. And so I was and because you're in the travel business, you tend to go in the winter. That's where you set up with your operators. So I would fly over in December and fly back in January, which actually it's my favorite time in Russia. It's very beautiful. And I took the route over the pole with Aeroflot. And I never forget that first trip back. I was coming back in an Aleutian 62, built in 1962. And by golly, it's the nicest flying jet I ever been in. But I was amazed. I was looking out the window. From horizon to horizon was this beautiful white landscape of snow and blue ice. I never saw blue ice ever before in my life. Because, see, I grew up in Phoenix, Arizona. In Phoenix, Arizona, blue ice was something you went to 7-Eleven, you put some ice in a cup and put some syrup on, happened to be blue. That's how you got blue ice. And so for me, it was like, oh, my God, I'm seeing blue ice, which is extremely old ice. And I was, over the years, I made that same winter trip 8 consecutive times. And what I noticed was that year after year, it was getting progressively worse. It wasn't where you had one good year and a bad year, hills and valleys, as Johnny Carson used to say. It wasn't that way. And that was when I just said, okay, I believe my lying eyes. There's something wrong with our planet. Because the last time I looked at the pole beneath me, and I was flying, I think I was an Aleutian 86 at the time, and I was just totally amazed. The whole Arctic looked like a busted windshield of a wrecked car in a junkyard. It was that bad. Just awful. And so I started doing some research, and I'm going, what's happening to the planet? And what's happening with the earth changes? And I got together with some other folks that were in Mensa, 3 of us, Mensa Society for Intelligent People That Are Socially Challenged. And we just went at this thing. We wanted to figure out this puzzle. And we started looking at other planets in the solar system. Because if this was a one-off thing, if it was just the Earth, and you know, then it's all of the political hype that's going on. But what we found was everything that had an atmosphere in our solar system was showing the same signs of perturbation. Even worse, at that time, Mars went through a period of global warming that if it happened here on Earth to that degree, we would now be extinct. It was that.
Well, now,
powerful.
Marshall, hold on a minute. I want to make sure that everyone's clear of what you're talking about. When you say that the pole looked like a cracked windshield, you're saying that the ice had cracked. There were lots of cracks in the ice. It was not a smooth, continuous northern pole ice sheet. It was just cracked. It was like melting and all that. Is that correct?
Yeah, it really looked awful. You know, go take an ice cube tray out of the refrigerator, throw it on the ground, that would have looked like.
Gotcha.
And it was just, it was awful. It was sad to see it. And because I'm looking at the Arctic, and now, you know, there are actually cruise ships that are doing inside passage cruises. And Russia and the United States are jockeying for position for offshore drilling where there used to be ice. I mean, this is a very sad thing, and it got me. Yeah, the thing of it is, John, when you see something like that, you don't give a hoot what somebody who's got a wall full of dead animal skins is telling you. You know what you know, and that was it. That was how I began. I knew what I knew. I knew the planet was sick. I had to figure it out. Well, and we started, you know, we obviously could see that this was a solar interaction with the planet. But we tested our solar interaction theory very simply. Just say if it's solar that's affecting us, then it's going to be affecting other planets that have atmospheres. And so, you know, you get Venus is one thing. We were seeing all kinds of strange things happening with Venus, but it was more in new radio emissions that were coming out. Mars was doing crazy stuff. The big eye on Jupiter started disappearing. they're just, we started going through an inventory of all the major bodies in our system, and there was just all kinds of solar perturbation going on. So we understood this just wasn't us. This, we're not having an argument about man-made global warming. This was solar driven, and that's what it is. It is what's happening right now is the sun is interacting with the Planet X system that's coming in. Let me explain Planet X system because maybe your audience isn't familiar with the topic.
And in fact, Marshall, explain first of all Planet X and then do the Planet X system, if you don't mind, please.
Okay. Planet X is an astronomical term, and it doesn't mean Planet 10. It's not Planet 7. It's not Planet 9. That's all misdirection and misinformation. Planet X is a term that was coined around 1905 by Percival Lowell, who founded the Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona. Percival Lowell was looking for an object European astronomers, since the discovery of Uranus, were trying to find, which they called Neptune's Perturber when he came along. What happened was Uranus was the first planet discovered with telescope, but Neptune was the first planet discovered with mathematics. How is that? Because there was a perturbation, there was a zigzag in the orbit of Uranus. And so that is something large that is pulling on the planet that's causing a deviation in the orbit. So they used that deviation, the mathematics were done, this was before computers, and they sent the stats off to an observatory in Berlin. And they found Neptune lickety-split. Boom, boom, boom. Just dialed it right in, went straight to it. Well, then they observed Neptune, and sure enough, Neptune's doing the same thing. It's got a zigzag in its orbit. And so the European astronomers then were looking for what they called Neptune's perturber. All right? And they couldn't find it. So what happened was Percival Lowell, who came from Boston, he got onto this. He founded the Lowell Observatory specifically, initially, to find Neptune's perturber. He created the term Planet X, which just simply means it is a planet that we know exists by virtue of the interaction between it and other planets. In other words, a Planet X is a planet you can't see, but you know it's there. Just as they knew that Neptune was there by watching Uranus. All right, same thing. So he created that term, Planet X. He was looking for it. In 1930, Clyde Tombaugh of the observatory discovered Pluto. Now, at the time, they thought Pluto was Neptune's perturber, but in the 70s, they discovered Pluto's moon, Charon, I believe it was in the 70s, and they were able to determine that Pluto's only about 60% the size of our own moon, which means it wasn't big enough to be Neptune's perturber. So the search is on.
It's about as big as a large asteroid, correct?
Well, Planet X is actually a planet.
No, I'm talking about Pluto.
Oh, Pluto. Pluto's a minor planet. It got demoted. And there were a lot of people that really felt sad for Pluto. I don't know, how do you feel sorry for a big rock? But a lot of people did. The interesting thing is we even have these Ceres and these other small minor planets, dwarf planets. And they have very thin atmospheres, believe it or not, and their atmospheres are showing signs of perturbation. It's all over the place. And what's coming in simply is big. That's it, big. Now, in 1940, there was an astronomer in Chile, Muñez Ferrada, Carlos Muñez Ferrada. In 1940, he announced the existence of what he called Hercolobus and a black star. Hercolobus is the Atlantean, is the name the Atlanteans used for Planet X, or what we call today Nibiru. And at that time, he presented calculations that showed that there was what he called a black star. Now, today, astronomers use the term brown dwarf to explain it, but it was called a black star back then because it was dark. You couldn't see it. And it's the same thing. So what he was talking about in 1940 is that we actually live in a binary star system. We have two stars. We have our sun, and in orbit around it is a small sun about twice the size of Jupiter, which astronomers have named Nemesis. And Nemesis is in an orbit of about 3,600 years. Now, going back to Nibiru, Planet X, Nemesis, being a brown dwarf star, has a mini constellation of planets and moons in orbit around it. And so it's a mini system. People go, how could that happen? Why wouldn't it go into the sun? Kind of questions like that. And it's real simple. Look at Jupiter. Look at all the moons of Jupiter. The moons of Jupiter are not falling into the sun. They're staying in orbit around Jupiter. Jupiter is in orbit around the sun. Nemesis, being twice the size of Jupiter approximately, same difference. It has its planet, and this is in a 3,600-year orbit. Now, it's important is that the orbit is in lunar calendar, not Gregorian calendar. And previous flybys of this system, what we call the Planet X system or the Nemesis system, the last one was Exodus, and before that was the sinking of Atlantis and Noah's flood. So these biblical historical events were actually flybys of the Planet X or Nemesis system around our sun. And the difference in severity between Exodus and Noah's flood is real simple. The object, when it comes through, will pass over our heads. And you're going to, you know, this is when it's really coming in, that's when you're going to hear all the fake news about, it's not going to hit us, don't worry about it, consume, be stupid, you know. I mean, I don't know, I look at the media today. I was a science feature producer for CNN in the 80s, and today I look at CNN and I go, my God, you guys are seriously retarded. And, you know, because there's no more professionalism in the journalism anymore, you know, on the electronic media. It's really sad. But I digress. The thing here is that this system is coming in and we are getting observations on it. We're seeing it. And I have been the first time we started seeing some of the objects in the system, or one of the objects in the system was 2013, and it showed up from a webcam from the Turrialba volcano in Central America. And it was extremely small at the time. I used to call it Blue Bonnet. And it has been, over the years, it's been increasing in size. And this last year, if you go to my website, Yowza, YOWUSA.com, the best Nibiru observation of 2018, this is what I call an at-altitude observation. And this is important for everybody to understand, because this is what you're going to see a lot more of in the coming year, are at-altitude observations of objects in this system. And what do I mean? It's folks, passengers, flying in jets with a good clear sky, and they look out and they see two suns in the sky. That's what they say. They literally see two suns in the sky. And they take video, and they see it with their eyes, naked eye observation. They take video. These guys from Russia, it was absolutely a stellar observation. And I will tell you, I'm very picky. Now, There's a whole lot of Planet X Nibiru videos on YouTube, and frankly, a lot of them are just crud. Okay, I got to be honest. They're just a lot of them are crud. I reject over 90% of the submissions I get, and usually I only publish on 1 or 2% of all of the submissions I get. I'm very picky. I want something that stands up under scrutiny. This observation that they did stood up under scrutiny, and I posted an analysis video. And you know, one of the things that resulted was YouTube demonetized my channel, even though I had no strikes of any kind, no complaints, no nothing. But they demonetized because I was reusing the video from these guys in Russia. Okay, let them keep their nickels and dimes. For me, what that told me when I was demonetized was that the elites are really worried about this. They know we're going to start seeing this year a lot of at-altitude observations. You're going to have a bunch of, excuse my French, folks, but a whole bunch of WTF videos going on YouTube. LinkedIn, Facebook, whatever, you're going to see a lot more of those starting to happen. And myself, I have seen it with my own eyes. I did that. That was September of this year, actually September 9th, probably the worst day of my life, because what I saw wasn't anything to celebrate. It's clean up the guest bedroom. Death's coming for a long visit. What it really is. So let's talk about the Planet X system. Now, I do discuss this a lot in my book, Surviving the Planet X Tribulation, and I give you a blow by blow on the system, but here's the short story. You got Nemesis, which is a brown dwarf star. Brown dwarfs are very difficult to see because they're shrouded by an iron dust cloud. Now, remember iron dust cloud, because what was the first plague of Exodus? The waters turned blood red. Well, go to a brickyard and ask them how they make those nice, fancy, decorative red bricks, and they'll tell you. They throw some iron in the mix, and voila, you got red bricks. Throw iron in the water, same thing. Then what happens is this is you also have impactors, and all of this stuff is bringing in a substance called shrebersite, which will cause blue-green algae to go absolutely apey. It goes crazy. And when that happens, what happens? It starts generating a very powerful toxin, microcystin. It is so powerful, this toxin, not only will it kill fish and frogs, this is the reason why the frog got out of the water, the fish were dying, and all of that. It'll kill animals. It'll kill a cow. It'll kill a human being. This is pretty tough stuff. And so you can take, if you take the whole story of Exodus, the plagues of Exodus, and reorder it from allegorical to scientific order, it's like a box of Legos, baby. It clicks together. Neck, attack, 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 attack. You want to know what's going to happen? Read Exodus. Get your Bible. Now, you have this brown dwarf star. Why is it impossible or very difficult to see it until it comes very close? It's because, unlike our sun, which had sufficient mass after it ignited to have a nuclear furnace, so to speak, and stay bright, a brown dwarf is like a charcoal briquette in your barbecue out in the backyard. You know how you wait until it gets nice and white and banked off, and that's it. Then you throw the ribs on. Well, a brown dwarf is like a charcoal briquette. It's not going to light. It's just going to bank off and burn slowly, although it takes a lot of time for it to happen. But the point is that it's not emitting light like our sun. And it is shrouded by this protoplanetary disk it has created of dust and debris and ice particles and whatnot. Now, it's a mini constellation. So Nemesis is big enough that it can then, it's able to, there's enough mass there to create planets. And what I write about in my book is that there are three major planets. The most innermost one is called Helion, then Arbota, and then Nibiru, which is the outermost planet. Now, for those of you who ever heard of Zachariah Sitchin and the term Nibiru from the ancient Sumerian scripts, it means the planet of crossing. And Nibiru is where the Anunnaki came from. Now, according to that work, if you read Zachariah Sitchin's work, is brilliant. Everybody stands on his shoulder. He did a fantastic job. I had a chance to know the man briefly. I was deeply impressed with him. And the one book by Sitchin, if you were going to read a book by Sitchin, would be The Lost Book of Enki. He did that. And the Lost Book of Enki is actually the autobiography of Lord Enki of the Anunnaki, who created our species. We literally are a fabrication of early hominid and Anunnaki genes. And so, and this was engineered under his direction. And there's a lot of history, and it goes contrary to what people want to believe, so it does stir up a lot of anger. But, you know, for me, I just follow the facts, and I don't judge it that way. I'm not going to compare it to something else. I just want to see. I want to see the truth. That's it. I just want to know the truth of it. So you have this brown dwarf, and this brown dwarf, then there's Helion, which is a very bright, smaller planet, rocky planet, almost probably looks like a second sun in that little mini constellation system. Then you have Arbota, which is a rocky planet, and you have Nibiru, which is a rocky planet, and it's the most furthermost outer orbit. Now, people ask me all the time when they're looking at these observation videos that are coming out, they're saying, what are we seeing, Nemesis? Are we seeing Nibiru or something else? I would say more like we're seeing a planet, not Nemesis, because Nemesis is still pretty deep on the other side of the system. And if you can imagine celestially, this system is moving on two axes, not one axis. All right. So it's going around the sun horizontally about every 360 days. That's, we're in matched orbits. But if it takes 3,600 years, that's its vertical axis, which is about 30 degrees inclined relative to, well, what Earth is doing in its orbit around the sun. And so you're moving on these two axes, and it's, that's what you have to imagine. And it's at this point, I think what we're seeing is a planet because it's very bright, which means reflected light. We're seeing the daylight side of whatever the planet is. Most likely. And sometimes you see one, sometimes you see two. It could be a planet and a moon. But we're seeing this stuff. If you look at the videos I posted on my website, you'll see what I'm talking about. Right now, we tend to, people are finding this between the 11 o'clock position relative to the sun to the 1 o'clock position relative to the sun. I can tell you that when I saw it with my own naked eye observation, it was very close to, I'd say around like 11:45 relative to the sun. And I did it there with another observer, someone I trusted. We both saw, she was the one actually who spotted it before I did. And, she went crazy. Oh, my God, I see it. You know, pull off the road. There we are in Warden, Washington, in the middle of, you know, wheat fields, and that's where we saw it. And it was, to me, just, you know, I have done so much analysis, looked at it so much over the years, boom, I knew what I was seeing. And I saw it, it was like, oh, man. Yeah, this is not a good day. I must have been horribly depressed for a week because it really does change it. You know, for all these years, I've been talking as a researcher and arm's length, and I could, you know, be dispassionate about. Now, once you see it, that's it. That's it. And you can't even convey to anybody the emotions that go to it, what goes through your mind. You know, for me, it was after that, I kept thinking about all these people over the years who sent me all their observation videos and stills. And I just spent a lot of time going, was I fair to them? Was I, you know, was I fair? And I felt I was. I wouldn't criticize them. I'd always say, here's the problem, keep trying. Here's the problem, keep trying. And, but it's profound. Now, I can tell you, I published the Colburn Bible, and this is an ancient wisdom text written in two parts. First part is the Egyptians. It was written about the same time as the five books of Moses. And the Egyptians, when they penned it, originally it was called the Great Book. And the Colburn, actually, in its initial incarnation as the Great Book, was about the size of a modern encyclopedia. And parts of it made their way as far north as England, because at that time, in the end of the Bronze Age, England was like the Saudi Arabia of tin, which was necessary for making bronze. And so there was a lot of traffic, and it was the Phoenicians who had the ships. The Phoenicians were the first ones in the ancient world that were able to navigate by the stars as opposed to following the coastlines. So their trading circuits took them as far as South Africa to the south and Britain to the north. And so,
wow.
Pardon?
I said, wow, that's amazing. And the whole point is, you got the star system that is starting to show up more and more. And
yes,
I know a lot of us heard about this during the mania of 2012. Now, and now you're saying, well, it really wasn't quite there yet, and it's coming around now. And so,
well, you know, back in 2012, I got to tell you, John, I was behind the eight ball, because I remember in the summer of 2012, I was interviewed by National Geographic, kind of annoyed the producer, because he was doing a show on 2012, and he said, Marshall, what's the relationship between Planet X and 2012? And I looked at him, and I said, it's coincidental. That's about the best I can say. And he said, well, what are you going to do on December 21, 2012? And I said, I'm going to make coffee, and I'm very serious about my coffee. And my prophecy came true. I had made coffee that morning, and I was very serious about it. But a little on down the road, we started a series on my website called Signs. Signs is already, we have 30 installments in this series. Well, I was wrong about 2012 being coincidental, because with prophecy, you have the prophecy, but good prophecy always gives you a benign harbinger, something that tells you you are on the destiny path to, you know, to a real big boo-boo. That won't really hurt you, take you out. And what the Mayans were doing was they had given their future descendants a celestial alarm clock, if you will. And this is how the ancient worked. They were very good with the sky. They could detect stuff. We don't know, because we just really don't know how to look at the sky anymore. We're too busy looking at smartphones. And so there was the harbinger sign that was there. Now, we've been tracking two data sets since December 21, 2012. To test that theory, was it a harbinger? Well, it was a harbinger. And we have seen, since we started doing the sign series, a steady month-over-month increase in two empirical data sets, fireballs and earthquakes of all magnitude. We do fireballs because This is stuff that's coming out of from the sky, but we're looking at earthquakes of all magnitude because this tells us the interaction between Earth and the sun, which is becoming brighter, and which is causing all of this, I call it crustal undulation. It's causing uneven heating in the core. So this is the reason why we're seeing land tears and sinkholes and all kinds of strange things in places we didn't see it before. All of this is because of this effect of this increased luminance bringing more light and therefore more radiation into, you know, upon our planet. And that's the reason why they do the chemtrail spraying. People, you know, there's all kinds of ideas why they do chemtrail spraying. It is real. I've seen them do it with my own two eyes, you know, and again, you know, I don't care if somebody's got a wall full of dead animal skins. I know what I know because I saw it. And what are they doing? Well, the whole point of chemtrail spraying is to reflect photons of light from the sun back out into space so they don't come down and strike the Earth. That's what it's all about. Why are the elites doing that? Because right now they're poisoning us to death with all this aluminum. Never before we've had this much autism, you know, aging diseases, all kinds of these aluminum things, bee colony collapse in places of raw, pristine nature, far, far away from anything human, and bee colonies are collapsing. So why are they doing it? The elites are doing the spraying now because they got their bunkers. They're called deep underground military bases. And when things start going sideways, they'll get the boarding call, and they're going to go down. How do you know when they're going down? Folks, just keep an eye on Denver International Airport, and when there's a whole mess of private jets all over the tarmac like a bad case of the measles, dying time is here, period. And so they're going to go down. Now, they don't want to come back to the surface after everything has settled down and find Earth has turned into another Venus or Mars. They want to be able to ensure that the planet, the environment of the planet, the biosphere, aquasphere, atmosphere, are going to be able to regenerate, that they haven't been destroyed past the point of recovery. And that's what all of this chemtrail spraying is all about, is radiation coming from the sun, because the sun is interacting with Nemesis, which is approaching. And in the next few years, things are going to start going sideways and getting crazy.
Wow. That's a pretty interesting synopsis. So what's going on is we've got a minor star system headed toward us. It's going to cause total havoc with our planet.
And it's already caused havoc.
And that's what's going on. So now what does everybody think? Devin and Papa Stroke, you know, we've all had times like, you know, everybody was scared of 2012. They said all this crazy stuff's going to happen. Marshall is saying that things are getting really ready to happen. I've seen some of his photographic evidence, and it's pretty scary. Now, if we have all of this happening, we have crustal undulation, we have earthquakes, we have problems with the climate and everything, what are we going to do? Devin and Bob Crow, what do you guys think? In your belief structures, do you have a place for the fact that the Earth could be torn up by something like this? We had it with Exodus about 3,600 years ago. What do we think?
It's very interesting. Marshall described it so very well that I can totally imagine and, you know, kind of think about what he's talking about. So it definitely makes me want to do more research into this and pay attention to it more.
Yeah, and there's a video on my website. If you guys really want to get started on it, it's called Planet X 101, Who, What, Why, Where, When, and How. That's Planet X 101, who, what, why, where, when, and how. And I give you the history going back to the discovery of Uranus. And I show you all the major players, all the names, all the people. When you hear somebody on there and they're going, it's a hoax created by Nancy Leader in 1995 and whatever, you know, watch out for the Pinocchio effect. Don't stand right in front of them because you don't want to have somebody's nose pushing out the back of your skull.
Gotcha. That's an interesting way to put it. So, you know, what's going to happen when all these displacements and all these problems occur? We are scheduled to have total havoc here on the Earth. Is that correct, Marshall?
Yeah. We're looking at 9 out of 10 Americans are dead.
So not basically 90% of the Earth.
We're looking at the reason why I'm saying 90%, that's just the power grid that fails. You know, when I started in this, and I call it validation research, where you're looking for information that proves to people what you're talking about, and a few years ago, I saw that there were new people coming in and they're trying out, and some were pretty good and others wish they'd stay home. But that allowed me to up my game to a whole new level. I said, I don't have to do validation anymore. We got to start talking about surviving. That's what we got to do. So what can I do to help people? Because that's my mission. My mission is to help people survive what's going to come. However, what I can do, and my philosophy is survival is more about the knowing of things than the having of things. Knowledge is important. So what I'm doing is I want people to get into two-way radio communications. And the reason why I want folks to do that is during a tribulation, a global tribulation, with all kinds of suffering and dying, you can bet your sweet bottom dollar that tyrants, predators, gang rapists, whatever, all these sickos, they're going to have two-way radios. They're not dumb. They may be stupid, but they're not dumb. Now, for the rest of it, if you don't have radios because you said, well, that's somebody else's, I don't have to do that. You know, well, then, good luck with that. But I wrote this book, Radio Free Earth, with Dwayne Brayton. And if you go to the website, radiofreeearth.org, I got an hour and 40 minutes of free instruction there to get you started. Again, remember, I want you to survive. It's not about selling you a book. Go watch the videos for free. You want to buy our book and take it to the next step? God bless and go for it. The sooner you start doing it, the better you're going to do with it. And because to me, two-way communications is critical. It's what I can do to help. Yes.
It really is. And I'm sitting here right now with a copy of Radio Free Earth. I bought my copy. I wanted to get it signed from you. But, you know, communication, we have some type of a global disaster. Communication is the single most important thing we can have to find out what's going on elsewhere. I mean, and Papa Stro, I know that you're a survivalist. You own a house with a farm, and you always talk to me about how you manage your resources there. I mean, you've got, you know, the appropriate guard dogs. You're a survivalist, right?
Absolutely, and I got friends that are survivalists and preppers, not only here in this area, but around the country. And we're always getting together and talking about things and talking about disaster scenarios like Marshall was talking about. And it makes sense because, I mean, the elites are going to look out for themselves. And they think these underground bunkers, whatever, they're going to save them from the inevitable, but I mean, just like I said in biblical, in the Bible, it's it won't nothing will save them from what's coming, and we have to us as individuals, as citizens, that aren't a part of the elite. We have to, like you said, have to get together and be prepared for what lies ahead, because I mean, all this was written in the Bible. All this is, I mean, even everything that Marshall said, it was written, and it's what we see. You know, I mean, we're living it, man. We're living it right now, and we just as individuals, we have to be prepared for what lies ahead. Because I mean, the Earth, whenever, let's say, for example, you know, let's face it, we've treated this Earth so badly, and whenever. Yeah. You treat nature as bad as we have treated it, it's going to let us know. And it's letting us know right now. Look at all the natural disasters you see around the world. And it's just a matter of time before not only Mother Nature lets us know, but the rest of the universe lets us know as well. And it's time for us to really wake up and be aware of what's going on and be prepared for what may lie ahead.
You know, you,
absolutely.
Pastor, you mentioned something that I really like. You said it was written in the Bible. It was written in the Bible because the Bible is, to a certain extent, it's a historical document to let us know what has happened before. And the fact is, we may very well, we don't know, but we may very well have a problem underfoot when we talk about Nemesis and the Planet X system coming to being harbingers of doom. Well, I mean, doom could be, you know, we all know that had the Carrington event from the 1800s, the mid-1800s, had the Carrington event happened today, we would all be back in the Stone Age because the entire grid would go down. Right, Marshall?
Absolutely. You know, in the videos that I did, now on my Radio Free Earth, I don't talk about Planet X at all. Never mention it. I take an all-hazards approach. In preparation for this, I have hundreds of hours of classroom training with FEMA. I belonged in Reno to ARES, Amateur Radio Emergency Service, and CERT, Community Emergency Response Teams. And I trained in the operations centers, and my training was very advanced. I was trained to a level where I could assist in communication coordination on major fire events where you're pulling in municipalities from everywhere. And the all-hazards approach is simple. You just prepare for if one thing's going to hit you, a dozen things are going to hit you, and you got to be able to deal with it. And so I took a lot of that experience and intelligence from the training I had, and the people that I trained with and I was involved with are just the most wonderful people. I mean, they're the kind of folks that you hope you can have as neighbors. All right, and that was what really. Now, where it really got me to the point where it opened up my mind about two-way communications in a way that's very different from other people, how they talk about it. Because if you talk about two-way radios, it's little compartmentalized conversations. You have first responders over here, commercial over there, taxi cab companies over here, hobbyists over there. And nobody wants to talk about what everybody else is doing and this, that, and that's all kinds of, you know, and they get all kinds of geeky and doing all nonsense. Now, for me, I don't do that. I look at two-way radios no differently than I look at a shovel, a knife, a gun, whatever. It is a tool to survive with. That's it. It's a tool. And with two-way communications, you're going to know you're up against people. The nasties are going to have the two-way communications. The elites are going to have the two-way communications. By God, you better have them, or they're going to be able to take you anytime they want. And what I do in the book is I show people and I say, look, there's all these consumer radios and amateur radios. I tell you how they can, not only how they work, but how you can use them together in a system-like approach for your community, because you're going to have a first level I call emergency, and that's for everybody. But a second level is going to be field operations, where you got people going out beyond your outer perimeter. And then finally, you're going to have a command and control level where you're talking about signals intelligence. And the thing about using two-way radios is you want to listen a lot before you key up the mic. You want to know who you're dealing with. And all of this is in there. And in the video series, I explained to it. But the number one thing now for me, the importance of two-way radios, is personal freedom. Yes, you need it for survival. Yes, you're going to communicate. I have people that say to me, well, Marshall, these are just gadgets. Humanity has dealt with disasters for all of our collective memory, and we didn't have radios. So what's the big deal with having two-way radios if humanity survived without them? Well, you can survive without the radios. The question is not whether or not you can survive without the radios. The question is, how much blood and treasure do you want to expend? Because the folks that didn't have radios, that cost them a lot of blood, cost them a lot of treasure. It'll happen too. You know, remember at the very end of the movie, Dances with Wolves, where we see the soldiers coming in to go kill the Indians, and they get to the campground and they're gone. Just some smoking fire pits. The whole point of it is that, yeah, you need to have firearms for defense, but let's be honest, with these modern cartridges that we have, with these defense rounds that we have, it's not like the old John Wayne thing of, you know, you get a lead bullet, you know, bite a stick and pull it out. You get hit one of these modern bullets, it's going to take a piece of your body the size of your fist and turn it into hamburger. And then you don't have 9/11. You don't have doctors. You don't have pain medicine. You don't have any of that. You just die badly. That's it. So, but if you have radio communication, when the bad guys get to wherever they think you are, they ain't going to find you. That's a whole lot better than getting into a gunfight and eating a bullet. That's the smart thing about it. So, you know, if
so
you're saying...
What you say, huh? Marshall, let's avoid the gunfight at the OK Corral. Let's be smart. Let's communicate with our people and go forward and stay away from those potential devastating problems, because if we do have an earth-wide problem that would cause the grid to go down or whatever, it's going to be everybody for themselves. And we've got to be able to communicate. Communication is the key. And I like that. That's one reason I bought your book. I mean, I got my shortwave technical license about a year and a half ago because I felt the need for it because of this exact potential situation, whether it comes from an EMP attack or whether it comes from, you know, Planet X coming in and destroying the grid. If something happens, we have to have Plan B because we have to live by Plan B.
You're talking to my heart, John. Absolutely. You got to have a plan B. Absolutely. But you know, it goes even beyond plan B. All right. And here's what I have a chapter in the book. And by the way, when you're talking about EMP attacks, a solar storm, that can do the number on us. You know, as a matter of fact, there's NIAC and the EMP Commission. Both of these were started by Congress. And the EMP Commission was the first to publish their results. And they said if the grid failed, 90% of all Americans will die, period. Because we have lost the ability to live without electricity. You know, people don't think it. When the power goes out, forget, you know, the water tap ain't going to work. Flushing the toilet ain't going to work. The elevators ain't going to work. Nothing's going to work. Everything's going to be total crisis. Cities are going to be awful. Folks are going to have to get out of the cities. It's going to be terrible. And during the early phases, that's going to be rough. But as things stabilize and we get to a time I call the backside. The backside is when we have blue skies and taste sweet waters once again. And we will have it. I'm not a doomer and gloomer. Okay? We're going to go through a bad time, but we're going to come out of it. I remember an old kindly gentleman once told me, he said, you know, when God destroys the world, he always saves a few good seeds to start over. And, and it's always been something that's stuck in my mind. But with the EMP, now I have three chapters in the book that are just about EMP. Right there. Three chapters all about EMP and what you can do and how you protect yourself and protect your gear. That's really important. EMP isn't going to kill us, but EMP hits a radio, it just cooks it in its own juices if you're not prepared for it. And so we have the three chapters there, but the one chapter that is the most precious to me is called Knowledge Exchange. And in my videos, there's one video that's called, Creating a Post-Disaster Alternet. Because right now, humanity is going to learn a big lesson. We are going to learn that centralized infrastructure serves the elites, and they use it to enslave us. And so whoever comes out of this disaster, it's kind of an interesting thing. People ask me, who's going to most likely be the ones to survive? And I say, people that are running around with Make America Great hats, they're the ones that are going to survive because they're in the middle of the country where there's the survivable areas. And the liberals, they live along the coasts, and they're going to be a bone to be chewed. I talk to somebody, as they say, well, I'm in Los Angeles. The first thing I ask them is, how long can you tread water? All right. You got the folks on the East Coast. All you got to do is have the western flank of La Cumbre de Vieja in the islands over there off of Africa. It pops. It's going to send a wall of water that's going to take out the coast from probably as far south from Maine, as far south as South Carolina, where you're at. And that's it. It's going to leave a mark. It's going to give you a real big rainy day, John. And
I'll tell you what, Marshall. There are some maps that have been printed and have been publicized about the potential damage that something like a Planet X could cause. So that's one particular type of damage. The other one is, of course, an EMP attack. And, again, that's why I got my license, and I think meeting you is fortuitous. I want to ask Devin and Papa Stroh a question about preparedness because they both know a lot of people. And, Devin, over there in your area of Hollywood, what would you say the sensibility is about, are we prepared if we had an EMP attack? If the thing came from a Carrington event, or if the thing came from an attack from North Korea, Devin, do people feel that they're ready for it, or are they kind of like blindly going along and not worrying about it? What do you think?
There's definitely a lot of people that are just too self-absorbed to even think about that level of preparation. But there's also a lot of people that are very conscious and aware of earthquakes and therefore other disasters and are, you know, preparing for them in various states of preparation. I'd say, you know, I'm not like the most prepared person, but I have thought about it and I have made provisions to get ready for, you know, in case of, you know, anything that could happen.
Right. And I think that's good. Well, I mean, Devin, that'll be great because if something bad happens, we'll be running Scarycast by two-way radio.
Yeah, that sounds – that I would do that. That would sound fun.
We probably ought to make a point of talking about that sometime.
Yeah, because I talk about that in my book. See, what I'm saying is that if we have the right kind of amateur two-way radios, you know, people don't think about it because, you know, it's always, well, you just push a – click a little button on the microphone, you talk to somebody. But you get into amateur shortwave radio, two-way radio. We're talking about you're in the $1,000 range and up. You have the capability, if you add the right equipment, you can send faxes, video, data files, Morse code, and teletype. You can go keyboard to keyboard. It's really amazing communication. Now, what's that going to make? Well, the knowledge exchange, what I call, we're going to create, the survivors are going to come together and create what I call an alternet. It is going to be a next version internet, but a big difference. It's going to be more like cryptocurrency. In other words, the elites aren't going to be able to own it and control it like they do now. You know, for folks like me, when we saw what happened to InfoWars, man, that was ice water in my veins. Now, I didn't follow Alex. Watched occasionally from time to time. I just pretty much keep my nose in my own business. But when I saw him get hosed on multiple social media platforms, oh my God, that was awful. That just, you know, we're going into this Orwellian age of Big Brother, and we are so there. You know, YouTube is for a lot of people that producers that make their living on YouTube. It's tough. It's wild, wild west, and the sheriff can be a mean drunk. So it's hard to get the information out because there's that centralized control. People are going to want to get away from that. One of the things I thought was a real interesting observation was that they were saying one of the, I believe it was the EMP Commission, said that, or NIAC, one of the two, but they said, the problem for us today, 100 years ago, Americans knew how to live without electricity just fine. Today, we don't. And people really don't understand what that means. What does it mean, living without electricity? All right, let me just give you a failure cycle for your cell phone so you understand, because that's one of the biggest things people say against two-way radios. Well, why bother with that? I got a smartphone. I can download apps. I'll do anything. So why go to the expense and the bother of learning some new technology? But here it is. When the grid fails, the failure cycle of a cell tower is as follows. Day one, voice and data services will be sustained because they're hoping for the power to come back on. Day two, the power doesn't come back on, and so what the cell tower then does is it terminates the data functions. Your Twitter, your Facebook, LinkedIn, Tumblr, bye-bye. That's all gone. Now you can call everybody and say, oh, my God. Day three, or third part of the cycle, is that now the cell tower is going to go from voice to 911 only. That is assuming 911 is going to pick up the phone, which they're probably not because they'll be inundated. All right. And then after the fuel runs out in the generator for the cell tower, the fuel bunker goes dry, it goes dark. And that's it. And your smartphone is good for one of two things. You can use it to record your last will and testament, and then you can use it for a grave marker. And that's what your smartphone's going to be good for. But let's go the rest of it, because the power goes out. What about modern medicine? Modern medicine is based on electricity. You take away electricity, hospitals, same thing. You got the failure cycle. Now, the hospitals have got huge generators with large diesel fuel bunkers, but they only have 3 to 5 days of fuel for continuous operations. So the hospital, like a cell tower, the first day, it'll all come back. Don't worry. It doesn't come back. Then they start cutting services. And finally, what happens? The hospital goes dark. You got a child that's a type 1 diabetic, start digging a grave. You got to go and get some sort of medical procedure like dialysis, start digging a grave. I'm sorry, but that's the truth of it. Then you're going to have all the other problems. If you don't have electricity, you can't pump the water. And now you have cities that are, like in the Midwest, you get the big towers up there and they're filling up the tower and you got gravity feed, but you got to get the water up to the tower. That's going to go away. But for major cities, you got to power the pumps. They don't have electricity to power the pumps. Water doesn't come out of the taps. If there's no power in the pumps, what happens to the sewage? Sewage stops, backs up. You can't flush the toilet. You can't get anything to drink. So now you're going to go, and let's say you're living in a luxury condominium 10 or 12 stories up. Well, the elevator ain't going to work no more. So you're going to have to go out and find some water, if you can find it, some food, whatnot, and drag it up 12 flights of stairs. That's going to be fun. But in the meantime, everything's going to be pandemonium. It's going to be darkness. And people who stay in the cities are not going to do well. But the people who say, let's get the heck out of here, that's what you're going to have to do. And their two-way radios are going to be essential because you can go out as small groups, large groups. In my video, Post-Disaster Communications, I give you the layout of how things are going to evolve and what kind of radios you're going to need as things do evolve. But they're going to go out. The thing about the cities is that's it. It's done. And, a lot of folks are saying, well, get gold and silver. Well, gold and silver are good for as long as you have somebody that wants gold and silver. But when people are hungry, you can't eat gold. Simple as that. So what's going to be the currency in kind? Heirloom seeds, freeze-dried protein, 12-gauge shotgun shells. That is going to be currency in kind in that situation. And these are the things that people, when you're thinking it through, you have to do it. And I'm not trying to say you got to be scared. To me, preparedness is not a person, place, or thing. Preparedness is a state of mind. I have folks that say, well, I got a whole bunch of boxes in the garage. I'm all set to go. I did my consumer thing. I went out there, big bang for the buck, as many calories as I can get for as little money as I can because I'm clever. And the funny thing is the people that buy that garbage, they never eat it.
Uh-huh.
And so what happens if you're 200 miles away visiting grandma and the guacamole hits the fan? All your stuff is sitting in a garage. You were so clever. You were a genius consumer of the world. You solved all your problems with simple consumer checklists. You bought the stuff, you put the boxes, now you're 200 miles away. And you probably, you